Celebrating 30 years of broadcast excellence. Now back to the Evening Rush with Earl Ingram on 1290 WMCS, the talk of the town.
All right, good afternoon, Milwaukee, again, and welcome to a Wednesday edition of the Evening Rush. In studio with me now is Sheriff David Clark. How you doing, sir?
Wonderful. Good afternoon to your listeners. It's good to see you.
You know, in all these years, I don't think I've ever seen you out of uniform. I thought you would go to sleep with the uniform on, man. Get up in the morning and it's all set. And
sometimes I feel that I do go to sleep in it. Sometimes I don't get to sleep. But, yeah, I had a staff meeting this morning, and so I thought I'd put on some business attire. Got the French cuffs and the dress shirt. And
don't you feel strange when you're out of uniform?
Not really.
Well, it's just strange to see you without a uniform on. All the times I've ever seen you. And you actually look like a normal person.
An executive.
Anyway, obviously there are many things.
Actually,
on the
I did
table.
This for you, man. They said, hey, you're going in to talk to Earl on Wednesday. And so I said, well, then I better look appropriate and press a shirt. And
well, I'm honored that you could come, and I'm honored that Kim could fit me into your schedule in the community, because there's obviously a lot of things going on, especially changes as far as the sheriff is concerned. And won't be long, and the summer will be here, and you guys will be rolling out your plan for the lake and
parks and right
and all those kind of things. One of the main subjects that I wanted to talk about today, and maybe we just get into that now, and then we can move on down the road. But it is the proposal of Governor Doyle to release inmates earlier than planned, and he's talking about maybe 2/3 of their sentences. After that, then he will start releasing them. And so let me do a little background. And the Governor Jim Doyle's budget plan to release some inmates early could put up to 1,000 criminals on the street and save as much as $27 million over 2 years. I can't emphasize enough that we believe we can do this safely, Corrections Secretary Rick Raysmith said. We're not opening the back door and saying it's time to leave. Under the plan, low-risk offenders shave off up to 1/3 of their sentences for good behavior. The move would save money and reduce recidivism, Raysmith said. Doyle's plan would allow certain nonviolent offenders who don't violate prison rules to earn one day off for every 2 days incarcerated. Those on extended supervision could also qualify for early release. The changes would apply to those who committed crimes on or after December 31, 1999, when the state's truth in sentencing laws took effect. Under another provision, the department would no longer supervise many misdemeanor offenders on probation. The budget would also invest $6.5 million in treatment, job training, and education, which Raysmith said are essential to ensuring offenders don't commit future crimes. But Raysmith said the state would save about $27 million for each inmate who has moved from prison to extended supervision. About 3,000 of the state's 22,000 inmates would be eligible for the program. But Doyle said he expected it would be 500 to 1,000 over 2 years. That would result in savings of $13.5 million to $27 million. Even with the change, overall spending on prisons would increase more than $50 million a year from $1.25 billion to $1.31 billion, the vast majority of which is paid with state taxes. Prison costs have soared over more than a decade because of truth in sentencing and other tough crimes. From the position of a sheriff who has now taken over the House of Correction, in addition to all the other things you do, what is your take on Governor Doyle's proposal?
Well, as you know, Earl, and one of the things I enjoy about being on with you, you've had me on before when you would fill in, and you know that there's two schools of thought. That's really all this is. I don't look at many of these situations and say there's a right and a wrong, that somebody's right and somebody's wrong, but there's two schools of thought. That proposal made by the governor is one school of thought. He thinks that he can save money by enacting these provisions with people who are locked up in prison. And I want to offer another school of thought.
And that's why I knew you would.
And you know what's ironic about this is back in the late 90s, the Department of Corrections was under a director named Walter Dickey. And at the time, Walter Dickey came up with a plan to do what he thought, it was a hypothesis, if we do this, we can save money and possibly rehabilitate and so on and so forth. And it was known as intensive sanctions. And what it was releasing state prison inmates early before their sentence was concluded and putting them under what he called intensive sanctions, intensive monitoring, drug treatment, job training, so on and so forth. And that idea failed miserably. Then Attorney General Jim Doyle, who's now our current governor, was highly critical of Walter Dickey and this idea of releasing career criminals early, even with, you know, under intensive sanctions. And like I said, then Attorney General Jim Doyle was highly critical of doing this. He said it wouldn't work. And when Jim Doyle ran for governor in 2002, he cited this issue as his, you know, tough on crime, that people shouldn't be let out early. He ran on, it was one of his platforms back in 2002. And it's just kind of ironic that you fast forward to today and something that he was highly critical of, that he said was not wouldn't work, and he said that it failed miserably, and the stats show it wasn't an opinion. And Jim Doyle, Attorney General Jim Doyle, was right. But now you fast forward to today, and he proposes this same idea and is trying to convince the public that this will work. And I'm just trying to, I'm puzzled by his change of heart. What made him think that this sort of thing back in the late 90s would not work, and now all of a sudden it will? And so I offered on Friday, because what he's talking about is an issue that needs public debate and discussion, first of all. This isn't something that should be done in a budget bill and kind of done under the, you know, with all the volume of paper and words and whatnot. This needs public debate and discussion and should be done on a separate action if he really wants to do this, because it does need to be discussed. And prison costs, correction costs are spiraling out of control. There is no doubt about that. We're on the same, the governor and I are on the same page, and something does need to be done. I've offered, and that's, I think, a discussion for another day, some suggestions as how we can get corrections and prison costs under control. But the problem I have with formulating public policy like this is the people who will be most affected by it. The overwhelming majority of people in our state prison system are from the Milwaukee County area, from southeast Wisconsin. So these individuals, when they're released, will be coming back to our neighborhoods, to our communities. These are individuals, and I'm basing this on, I do extensive reading on the research and the studies that have been done. I haven't done the studies. I'm a cop, not a research academic or research scientist. But I do read these things because I'm very interested in it in terms of how we should approach public policy in terms of public safety, and not only in the state of Wisconsin, but specifically in the Milwaukee area. And several studies were put out by the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute. This is a nonpartisan group that does, you know, they're tasked to do studies on certain things. And they published three studies back in the late 90s and the early part of 2000. They took a look at who the state prison inmates, who really makes it up. I mean, what, you know, their backgrounds, their, you know, all the demographic stuff on them. And then they took a look at the sentencing practices and how long they're in prison. And the recidivism rate is one. It's a separate report because that is an issue. What they found was that 94% of the people locked up in prison, 94% have been convicted of, either currently or sometime in their criminal past, of a violent crime. 94%. They also found that 90% of the people, when they did this sample population, who are released from prison end up returning to prison for continued criminal career. So that's a high recidivism rate. This is the population that Jim Doyle now all of a sudden has this faith in, that like a light switch can turn it around and adhere to society's rules. These are the individuals that will be coming back to our neighborhoods, our community, and the likelihood is, based on the research, that they will reoffend. It takes an awful lot to put a person in prison. We don't put people in prison on a whim. And I'm not suggesting that there isn't a case where someone went and you get into they weren't guilty. You know, I understand that's a whole subject for another day. But they took a look in one of these studies. Like I said, they found that 94% had a conviction for a violent felony, either currently or in their past. So they took a look at the demographic, and it's just littered with. And I brought a couple of examples just to show, and we don't have the time to go over it, but to show that, you know, I don't speak anecdotally and just off the top of my head, of people in the Milwaukee area who were sentenced to prison that did come out early, came back, committed more horrendous acts and ended up back in prison. But see, those, the victims of those are disproportionately people from our community as well. How would you like to be, and I don't mean this toward you,
right,
because you understand this, a single mom raising a kid or even married parents, okay, in the black community in Milwaukee, doesn't even have to be in the central city, trying to raise kids. You want a safe environment. The number one thing on parents' minds when they go to sleep at night is, you know, is my family going to be safe, either at school, in our home, in our community? And they look to law enforcement to get that done. These communities that are littered with dope houses, and by the way, drug offenders, major drug offenders, would qualify under Jim Doyle's nonviolent, his nonviolent model. And I got a huge problem with that, because what one of these studies also showed is that the overwhelming majority of people in prison on a drug offense are major drug dealers who are members of notorious street gangs. So this myth of the nonviolent offender and just people, you know, our prisons are full of people just on drug offenses, it just kind of doesn't exist.
But Sheriff Clark, you would admit that at some point in time there's a law of diminishing returns. The system is overwhelmed. The financial cost that's associated and tied into prisons and locking people up, especially young men, for 25, 30 years, has gotten to a point where the state can no longer afford it. They're receiving less money from the federal government. It is taxing other aspects of the state. At some point in time, the lock them up, throw away the key theory, three strikes are out, truth and sentencing, no parole, all of those situations that came up in the early 1980s, those laws, or the late 1980s, that were changed, that added to the explosion of the prison population, and especially with young African-American males, has now come to a point where the state can no longer afford to do that. And the real tragedy of all of this is, even though we've locked all those young men up, there's a whole slew behind them who are waiting to undergo the same tragic fate. So the answer can't continue to be lock them up and throw away the key, because there will be no end in sight. The governor, I can understand, is in a position where he's got to make some tough decisions. And, you know, when you're talking about the nonviolent offenders, we know that most of those young men have really wound up going to prison because of drug offenses.
Drug dealing. Not drug using.
Yeah, well, drug dealing.
Drug dealing, and you know, I'll make this very clear, and it should come no surprise to your listeners. I'm not an advocate for people who peddle poison. Drug dealers are destroying neighborhoods. They're destroying lives. They're destroying other people's lives by peddling that poison, and they're never going to get any.
Total agreement with you on that.
Soft spot for me. But you're right in terms of the way Wisconsin approaches corrections now. And I've said this previously, and I say it every opportunity I get in news conferences and discussions with the media. We need reform in our corrections policy in Wisconsin. The governor is correct on that. I just think going about it this way, this social engineering, this social experiment, is dangerous, and the people who are going to pay the highest price are the people in the neighborhoods.
Well, there's
no
rehabilitation in prisons anymore.
Never was. Okay. Well,
I do remember reading some statistics that said even when there was, maybe 7% would be rehabilitated, the other 93%
would have a tough goal. Here's the challenge. I think that we can accomplish some of this reform and control some of these costs in a number of policy shift ways that apparently the governor and Secretary Rick Ramish either don't want to pursue or haven't thought about. One of the ways that we can reduce prison costs, we had already undertaken as a state back in the early 90s, They were shipping prison inmates to serve their time in other institutions throughout the United States. One of the reasons they did that was because it was costing less to house a prisoner in some of these other institutions. Now, in 2003, Governor Doyle ended that program and returned 5,000 outstate prison inmates, back into Wisconsin's already overcrowded prison institutions. And at the time, State Senator Gwen Moore, her office released a report on whether this was a good idea or not to end this program. She didn't say it, but it was a report that was issued by her office where an analysis was done, and the recommendation was that it was not wise to return these 5,000 prisoners to an already overcrowded prison system. So I would have to ask, if it's already overcrowded, Governor Doyle made a bad situation
worse. There was a lot of pressure from inmates' families who said that we don't have an opportunity to go and visit our child who was in prison.
Right. That was one of the issues that was brought out, which is why one of the reasons why the governor made this policy shift. But one of the ways of reducing costs, you know, you get the outstate program, but that isn't the only one. There is a law on the books in Wisconsin that prohibits private institutions from operating prisons in Wisconsin. So if this issue about families wanting to visit, and that's an issue, okay, so if we want to rectify that, one of the ways to do it, if we want to keep them in state, is lift that prohibition and let private corporations that do this throughout the United States, and I think there are 32 states that have privatized some or all of their state prison operations, allow outstate prison corporations to come in and either build it on their own, so it's no cost, you know, I mean, not a passed on cost in terms of taxes to build these, because you're never going to, the brick and mortar, you're never going to outbuild, you know, more than these individuals are coming into the system. But studies have shown, there was a Harvard Law Review report issued in 2002, and that study indicated that it says here, the Harvard Law Review report analyzed that correctional services provided by private prisons usually outperform public prisons in the area of costs, which is what we're talking about, accountability, and operational flexibility. They use fewer administrative personnel and implement effective programs that reduce overtime and employee use of sick time. So that's one way, by allowing, and then the state would be able to start selling its prison assets, the buildings and everything, to a private corporation, and then contract out and let them do it. They can do it at a much lower cost than it costs for the state to operate. So there's another, you know, just
well, you kind of even can envision that for the House of Correction.
Darn right, I
can. Yeah, and I know that's something that you certainly have thought about and talked about. But I guess from the perspective of the people, the employees, it, certainly if it's privatized, unions aren't going to be involved. And so those private entities will be able to determine what they're going to pay. And many people who are in those unionized jobs will more or less lose their jobs once it becomes private.
Well, no, that's not necessarily true. And the way this works or can work with privatization, the state can, in the contract mandate, you will take these employees, you know, that are now state employees, and those are the ones that will get the jobs. Now, obviously, some things are going to change. If the private corporation operated just like the state, there wouldn't be any cost savings. But, you know, as you indicated, and as is the case, you know, this stuff is bankrupting the state of Wisconsin. So we can't continue to have these individuals on the state payroll at these high costs, you know, high benefit packages, high pension costs, and not have it break the state's bank. So, yeah, that is one of the things, you know, things are going to be different. But we can't sit up here and continue to throw the problems up and say, well, we shouldn't do it because people might not make as much money. I mean, is that what this is for? Or is this for, you know, to safeguard societies so that people can, you know, make a nice living? That is a part of it, but that can't be the sole consideration. And right now it is, right?
I mean, I'm in agreement with you that it certainly the decision shouldn't be based on whether or not some unionized members are going to lose their jobs. But and I don't think that that's the direction or the way that the governor's looking at it. He's at a point where they can no longer, how many more prisoners can we can we handle? You obviously at the House of Correction have your hands full on a daily basis. I think if people really realize how many young men and how many people are locked up, they would be amazed. I had an opportunity on one occasion to actually go into the House of Correction and look, and I couldn't believe my eyes with what I saw. Where are those young men eventually going to go in where they are now? I mean, if they don't change or correct their behavior, where are they headed? And I believe that it's because, for the most part, Sheriff, there are no jobs out here. I don't happen to believe that crime is caused, jobs leave because of crime. I don't believe that. And the reason I don't believe that is, having been in the city my entire life, and when there were jobs here, the crime rate was very low. Once all the jobs left the city, the crime rate went through the roof. Now, we can look at it from any way we want to look at it, but when there are plenty of jobs available, the crime rate is low. But once the jobs leave, the crime rate soars. It'll take a rocket scientist to figure out something occurred that made people turn to crime.
Sure, and there is a correlation to this. However, I still do not believe that because someone doesn't have a job, it's not an appropriate response to resort to criminal activity.
I'm in agreement with you on that.
What do we do about employment and getting people employed? The economy shifted back from the time when you were talking about. We went from an industrialized right. to the, you know, the tech age, and then we saw the jobs go overseas and that issue. But the economy changed, and there wasn't much that was going to be able to be done to stop it. So then what happened, what I think needs to be looked at, is why the people who were in position at the time, the political powers, didn't see the shift coming and didn't start to prepare for it. Another suggestion I have is I think we're working on this thing from the wrong end. What I want to do, Earl, is prevent the younger generation of black men coming up, you know, the 13, 14, right. and 15. I want to prevent them from developing these criminal tendencies and then, you know, having them continue to repeat the behavior, and then they end up as today's prison inmates.
I'm in total agreement with you.
And I will support more funding for programs on the front end, not the back end. I think those guys had their chance. We are a second chance society, but we're not talking about a second chance for some of these guys. I got a guy here, and I don't need to get into the name.
Right.
I'm not here embarrassing anybody. He's born in 1961. He's been arrested 32 times. We're talking about with that individual, and he's not an anomaly, but we're not talking about a second chance with him. Earl, I'm telling you, you call me heartless if you want, but I'm not. I don't want to spend any more money on him or time to figure out what to do with his life. I want to look at the 12, 13, 14-year-old young man now and see what we can do to keep him in school, to get him as much education as we have so he can get out here and compete in the new economy, not in, you know, in these sectors that the jobs are doing.
Believe it or not, you and I are on the same page with that. I've argued for the longest the real key should be to prevent others from following the footsteps of the young men who've already made the mistake. We make the mistake on not trying to do anything to shut the faucet off and stop young men from following that path. And I've been arguing that point forever. I'll continue to argue that because to me it seems like nobody seems to care that at some point in time we've got to prevent young men from going first, not
right.
worrying about rehabilitating them after they come out.
After it becomes ingrained
behavior.
There's
so many people who apparently for whatever reason don't see that.
And well, you need to be commended though as well for not only arguing that but exhibiting what you say, but by working with the young men that you do. I'm well aware of that, the programs that you're involved in. You're right. We got to spend more of our discussion, more of our effort, more of our energy, more of our limited funds on the front end
right.
and not on the back end. So a lot of the things that exist in the prison system today, and I don't say too bad, but they're not going to get a lot of sympathy from me, Earl, because it was their behavior that landed them there.
All right, we got to go to a break. You got time for a couple calls?
Sure.
All right. Mr. Thompson, Michelle, hang on. We'll come directly back to you after the break. In studio with me is Sheriff Clark and Miss Kim Brooks. How you doing, Kim?
I'm good. How are you?
All right, how's the baby?
Great.
All right. All right, you're listening to 1290 WMCS, The Talk of the Town.
celebrating 30 years of broadcast excellence. Now back to the Evening Rush with Earl Ingram on 1290 WMCS, the talk of the town.
All right, I know we were long, Sheriff Clark, and I know there are folks waiting to get on the air, but, you know, I really wanted, and I knew your perspective on things, because I think I've listened to you long enough, and I know, for the most part, that your law and order, and certainly doesn't matter who it is, if people are breaking the law, you want to make sure that the citizens who really have been under siege for far too long in our community.
Neighborhoods.
Yeah,
and, neighborhoods. And like I said, predominantly ours.
Right.
You're right. And for me, and there's more than one way to get this done, public input is important. But at the same time, at the end of the day, for me, I want you, I want your family, I want everybody in the Milwaukee area to feel safe in their homes, in their schools, in their neighborhoods, and that their kids go out and play. They can go down to the 7-Eleven. They can go to the ATM without having a gun stuck in their face and their car, and all that nonsense that goes on. I don't want people to have to live like that.
All right, we're going to go directly to the phone lines. Mr. Thompson, you're first up.
Hey, how you guys doing this evening?
Doing fine. You have a question for Sheriff Clark?
I have a comment and a question. I read his blog, and what I was most interested about is when he talked about the outsourcing of prisoners, and you guys brought that up on the show today. And there were, you know, they brought all those guys back in 2003. Well, there's still some prisoners that are still up. However, there are people that are in our penal system for disorderly conduct, habitually. Disorderly conduct, we got people that are actually in prison for disorderly conduct, you know. So, and I understand that could turn in or erupt into something violent, but we have people that are in our, you know, child support that are in our system, you know. And the outsourcing of prisoners, Corrections Corp of America, where it's actually is still traded every day on the
New
on
York
Wall
Stock
Street.
Exchange.
It's a trading stock. Human lives every day is traded. So, and then I look at the situation to where we have guys that go to jail, and then there used to be you could take a trade in jail and get out, and you could get a job. But now there's no need to give an inmate any education, because when he get out, there's nobody hiring him, because the law has been set up and it's been positioned that why pay for a guy's education that's probably going to do life, and we're paying for his education and he's never going to get out.
Okay, so Mr. Thompson, do you have a direct question you want to ask the sheriff?
Well, I have a question. What is his actual, what is he actually, what does he have any stake in outsourcing prisoners out of the state of Wisconsin into places like Mississippi, Texas, Alabama, and Nashville, where the headquarters of that organization is? And I know he'll probably say no, and I think he's doing a marvelous job, but he'll probably say no. But
well, let him answer it. Thank you very much for the call, man. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Thanks for your question. Thanks for your call. No, I don't have any stake in prison corps or any of these correctional industries. And the only stake that I would say indirectly I have is I don't want dangerous individuals returned back to the Milwaukee area to live among the law-abiding citizens at the, you know, strictly for budgetary reasons. I think there are other ways to get this done that are not being explored, and that's my issue. The caller mentioned that he knows that there are people in prison for disorderly conduct. and you know, a lot of this is, he may mean something else, and I don't know that. But there's nobody in prison for disorderly conduct. The reason I know that, disorderly conduct is a misdemeanor punishable by up to 9 months in jail. And in order to go to prison, it has to be a sentence of 1 year or more. So even if you got two disorderly conducts, you know, they don't,
it's
make
not
it 18
part of, it's
and
not
send
part
you
of
prison.
Three strikes, you're out, in other words.
No. The thing about the nonviolent offender, you know, we got to deal with the data that exists. And like I said, 94% of the people who are currently in prison have been convicted of, either currently serving for at some time in their criminal career. And we're not talking about two or three arrests. Like I said, the one gentleman I have that's been arrested 32 times, he's 37
but
years old.
But you will say that's the exception, not the rule.
I won't even say it's the exception. Not of people who are locked up in prison. And this gentleman isn't even in prison. So when we talk about, you know, who is actually in prison versus who is out. And the other thing one of these studies pointed out is 75% of people convicted of felonies are not even in prison. So there's really, and there are a lot of people in prison. Our prisons are overcrowded, but it isn't like, you know, anybody convicted of a felony goes to prison. It just doesn't happen. And I would agree, because this has been pointed out before, you know, about our system of criminal justice has some flaws. It's not a perfect system. I'm not here to abdicate for, or advocate, I should say, for that this is fair and it's all on the up and up. But here's what I would say, and here's how I was raised by my mother and father, knowing that this system sometimes is unfair and can discriminate. They always advise me, stay out of it. Don't get caught up in it. It's not like these individuals are being snatched off the street and they're upstanding, law-abiding, and they're political prisoners and we're just holding them in prison. Many of them, unfortunately, are career criminals. And the caller also mentioned the last thing I'll say about what he touched on. You know, he says, when they get out, there's no... And, you know, we're focusing on when they get out, what may happen, there's no jobs. And I want to focus on, why are they getting in there? Why are they ending up in there? Let's work on our youth. Let's work with our young people to prevent them from becoming a career criminal, having this ingrained behavior, ending up in prison, and then we got to worry about how we're going to find them a job. They're a convicted felon. We're working on the wrong thing.
All right. In studio with me is Sheriff Clark. It is 4:39. Michelle. Michelle, you're next up.
Yes, hello, Earl.
And hi, you have a question or comment for Sheriff Clark?
Yes, good afternoon, Sheriff Clark.
Good afternoon, Michelle.
A quick comment in my question. I do think that it's rather interesting, Sheriff Clark, in listening to you, that you choose to overlook in some of your research or the information you provide that there are situations in which individuals have, A, been wrongly convicted and are incarcerated, that before truth and sentencing occurred that there were people that should have been coming out through the regular parole process, which has been severely stagnant or halted because of some political things that happened with a release, and that people are being deferred after having served more than 75% and 80% of their sentences prior to truth and sentencing because of lack of program. You know, there is no anger management. You can't get into this particular program that was mandated by your release terms. And so folks are being sent back. Do 6 more months. We'll see if we can get you in a program. I don't know, and I don't understand why those people potentially couldn't be released under the governor's initiative. I'd like to get your input on that. And one other quick thing, I guess I am going to challenge your belief that we need to put most of the efforts into the before versus the after. I'm looking, I think, for a balance to be proactive and, in some ways, I don't know if the word is reactive, but to address what goes on, because as we see more and more young people trending into prisons, the 9-year-old who just actually was able to enter into a plea agreement about killing his dad and his dad's friend at 9 years of age. This kid, all his life he will have known is prison. And so when he comes out, we are going to need to, if he will get out at 18, we're going to need to have some things in place to help this young man re-enter and have some kind of life in society. So I don't think that we can do a service to our community if we only look at the front end and not deal with the fact that not everybody that goes in will do 10, 15, and 20 years. Some of these folks are going to do 5 and 7. They're going to come out. They got families to support. They need to be able to contribute. There has to be a balance. But I'd like you to address that the earlier statement about folks that were in there before truth and sentencing.
All right. Thank you very much for the call, Michelle.
All right. Some very good points, some very good insight. And I'll repeat, first of all, something that I said earlier in the program is I'm not going to advocate for career criminals, for people who have continually violated society's rules. I understand that many of these individuals have other issues going on. we have some mental health issues. But for the people who are going to use the reasoning of no jobs, I'll again say that's not an appropriate response to not having a job to go hold up a citizen or a convenience store or whatever. The issue of programming and the fact that there isn't enough money to go around for programming might be the case, okay? But the answer is not to let career criminals out, those who have continually, not second chance people, those who have continually and repeatedly engaged in violent criminal behavior, to let them out because we don't have, you know, adequate programming on the front end, so on and so forth. I still think it's worth the effort with the little money we have to continue to work on our young people and not to, you know, we talk about anger management. Well, you know, I'm not a social scientist. I don't really have an answer for that. What do we do with people with anger management programs? There are problems. There are programs that I understand that there's not enough funding. I understand that. But the answer isn't to let violent career criminals out because we didn't have enough money to put into programs on the front end. There is no silver bullet to this. There's just not. I think that there are other things that we need, that the governor should pursue in terms of public policy. What do we do with these costs that are out of control? What do we do with the fact that our prisons are bursting at the seams with people predominantly men of color, black men, you know, our brothers or sisters, I'm sorry, our husbands, our sons. But again, we got to look at why they ended up in there in the first place and what broke down there and what we can do to improve those things to prevent. And I think prevention, and you mentioned it, Earl, with the work you're doing with young men, that's going to go a lot further than us wringing our hands about what do we do when men get out of prison, there's no jobs, they have families. Well, that existed before they went in as well. The time to answer that is not after they, you know, are convicted of a drive-by shooting or selling large quantities of dope or, you know, holding up the 7-Eleven. The time to deal with that is before that happens, not after they're convicted.
Do you think that because you're in law enforcement, you see obviously crimes that many of these young men have committed, that you see them from a different perspective than people in the community who don't realize some of the violent crimes that have been committed against these citizens?
What I see and what I have seen in my 30 years of doing this, and I started as a patrol officer, worked extensively in criminal investigations, worked homicide, worked the violent crime squad, supervised those units.
Work your way up, in other words.
Worked my way up. But I got to talk to a lot of young men who got caught up in this stuff. You know, sitting right next to them or across the table and going through a lot of things, not just trying to get them to confess, but
right.
Trying to piece together how this thing got out of control like this. And really, you know what, the common threads that were woven through this is they weren't thinking about the consequences at the time.
So it wasn't the lack of family?
It wasn't. Those may have been contributing factors on the periphery, but they weren't thinking of the consequences at the time. You know, what would happen after something like, and really a lot of them said that. I never really gave that any thought. I saw that as a common theme, and getting caught up in the moment and peer pressure and not making their own independent decisions, and I don't think this is the smartest thing to do today, but more about being accepted, you know, that sort of peer pressure type of thing. And lifestyle choices, Earl. You know, do I go and with these guys here, they've made a decision to go rob a dope house, or do I say, hey, not tonight? And that's a tough thing for a person going through adolescence
right.
to do, because you have this wanting to be a part of something, a group, not of hold-up men, but wanting to
You're
be.
Right.
I mean, human beings have that need. And they don't see it ending up as somebody's going to be dead, though. They think, we'll go and we'll get the money, we'll get dope, we'll run away,
right.
and everybody will be fine, we'll split it up. And that's what I mean by they don't think about the consequences. So some of the things that can be done that don't cost a lot of money, as you know, and you're working with young men, and you talk to young men about lifestyle choices.
Daily basis. Right.
You talk to young men about the consequences of their action. and that there's prices to pay for some of this stuff. But it can't just be a one-time thing, as you know. It's got to be repetitive and over and over and over and over again. But they're not thinking. I'm telling you right now, most of these individuals are not in prison because there's no job and because of, you know, all these other things that I'm hearing that yeah, the economy sucks right now. Okay, but back during the 80s, we had close to full employment, and we still had this criminal activity going on.
All right, and I know you got to get out of here, so let's take these last two calls. You got a couple of minutes?
Let's do it.
All right, Ron, you're next up with Sheriff Clark.
Good evening.
Thanks for waiting.
No problem. First, I'd start out by saying that I think that the community ought to be very proud that we have Sheriff Clark.
Thank you, sir.
On a more personal level, I know my sister was a nurse at the county jail for a number of years, and when she passed, we found his office to be very much receptive to the types of things we needed. And so we thanked him for that in writing. I hope you got it, Sheriff. And we thank him now.
You're very welcome.
My cousin, Scott Mathis, just recently passed. Mm. He was a deputy sheriff, and Sheriff Clark's men, you know, they were there, you know, for us, my family, and everybody. And so, again, I thank him for that. And he's human, so I want people to understand.
Yeah, he is.
On the other side, though, Sheriff, and I'm a supporter of yours, but there's a couple of things that practicing criminal defense has taught me. And I just think the studies that you took a look at are very much flawed.
Okay.
A number of our children are being arrested because of their presence. You and I are both very familiar with the fact that if you roll up on a group of guys and everybody throws down some weed or a couple of people throw down some weed, well, if there's 10 people there and two bags of weed, 10 people go to jail. That's an arrest. So if we turn around and we look at numbers of arrests as a measure of whether or not, you know, what type of law enforcement we're going to do, I think that you get some very skewed results. We don't have a control over who arrests who. That's a matter of that officer on the street. And I will say the sheriff's department does a much better job of discerning who to arrest and who not to arrest than, unfortunately, our Milwaukee Police Department. I think that they're much more concerned about getting the right person as opposed to getting quantities of people in custody. But I think that that has to have a strong bearing on how we look at those numbers that come out of the Public Policy Forum and others. And then the other thing, though, that, man, I can't imagine how many times that I have looked at these young guys who come in and it's the jobs, Sheriff. It's the fact that they don't have anything to do. I agree with you 100% that they're not looking at consequences. We grew up in a different kind of environment. I spent a little time in custody myself, you know, but I came out, made something of myself, et cetera, et cetera. But unfortunately, we don't have the kind of support now that we did then, both inside and outside of prison. When I was in jail, you had education was encouraged, trades were encouraged, all of these kind of things. You weren't getting out of there until you could come out of there and at least have a decent shot, despite having a criminal record, of doing something. And many people I know took advantage of it. They've never went back into the system.
Hey, Ron, we're getting long, man. So
okay, I'm sorry about
go
that.
Ahead.
But I just wanted to say that because I'd ask you to take another look at the impact of jobs on young people's criminal behavior. With that, I'll hang up, and y'all keep this good discussion going.
All right,
thank you very much,
sir.
For the call, Ron.
First of all, let me touch on Sergeant Mathis, who passed away.
Excuse me, Sheriff, how much time you got? You got a couple more minutes?
Sure.
You can wait through the break?
We can do this.
All right, you want to respond after the break?
Sure.
All right, so he's going to respond after the break, and Yolanda, and we'll come back to you directly after the break. You're listening to 1290 WMCS, The Talk of the Town.
If your son or daughter is a high school senior planning to attend a college or university in the fall, please make sure to apply for a Willie D. Davis Scholarship Fund. This year, 25 students will receive $2,000 each. To log on to 1290WMCS.com to download your applications today. Or you can stop by our studios. We're located at 4222 West Capitol Drive, Monday through Friday between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. All applications must be submitted no later than March 30th, 2009.